I'm joined today by Sydney-based author, essayist and anthropologist, Keridwen Dovey, the author of several works of both fiction and non-fiction, as well as a regular contributor to The New Yorker and The Monthly. She has just published her fourth novel, Life After Truth. The book takes place in the United States and follows five close friends attending their 15-year college reunion when one of their former classmates turns up dead. I should mention that the college where the novel is set takes place at the famed and prestigious Ivy League school, Harvard University. And I should also mention that the author herself attended Harvard from 1999 to 2003, alongside some very well-known alumni such as Natalie Portman and Jared Kushner. Keridwen Dovey, welcome to Drive.
Thank you, Tina.
There's so many interesting themes running through this book, and from the outset it might seem somewhat Agatha Christie-like, but what it actually recalled to me was the film The Big Chill, in the way that it explores the lives of these five friends all brought together under the same roof, like they once were in college, all in their late 30s and grappling with anxieties and regrets and what-ifs. What was the catapult for you which made you want to explore these themes?
I'm so happy that you got the big chill feeling from the novel. That's the highest compliment you could pay.
Oh, good.
That was definitely on my mind. Just actually while I was back at my own 15-year reunion, and that sense of just revisiting the past and the way that you're thrown back on old friends who you maybe don't know so well anymore because your lives have moved on, but you're put back into this very intense social situation. And I was also thinking about Donna Tartt's The Secret History, and I've always loved a sort of campus murder mystery. And even though, as you say, this is not exactly that, but there's something about, you know, an American campus because it's such a closed off space to outsiders that it's interesting to then track people who've been insiders, who've been students at this very prestigious university, and then they've been kicked out to go off and, you know, fly or fail, as it is, and in their post-college lives, and then they're allowed back into the campus for these long weekends for the reunions. And so I went back for my reunion in 2018, and you can actually stay in the same dormitories where you slept as a college student.
I found that remarkable. So
even at a sensory level, it's just a very kind of strange, wonderful experience. So I just had this heightened emotional experience kind of communing with my earlier self and, you know, wondering what I'd done with my life. And I had a lot of very interesting conversations with my peers who were all feeling similar things. And so I came back from that experience not having planned to write a novel about it at all, and realized that I think I might have to put this down in fiction.
I mean, that whole situation seems like it would be great inspiration for a novel. It's a very specific age and demographic you're writing about in this book. The late 30s, the questioning of life choices, the fear of unrealized dreams at the gates of middle age, and I guess just trying to survive the minefield of a generation growing up in late capitalism. One of my favorite lines in the book is a quote from the psychologist Daniel Gilbert. "Happiness is a noun, so we think it's something we can own. But happiness is a place to visit, not a place to live." Was this on your mind at all when you were at your own 15-year college reunion? I mean, as you said, it's your memory is really getting triggered even on a sensory level due to being able to return to your surroundings in such a specific way. You must have really been comparing and contrasting and really stacking up your own dreams and aspirations, which I'm sure came flooding back to the reality of your life as it was in the present day.
Yeah, I mean, I think anybody approaching 40, you know, the midlife crisis thing is real, but I felt like it had been misrepresented in, you know, the cultural stories that I had consumed about this phenomenon of approaching 40 and early middle age, particularly for women. And I was really interested in more looking at intellectual midlife crises for some of the female characters in the book, and that it's also this amazing time of growth and challenging preconceived ideas and really, you know, letting go of a lot of the, well, what Jung calls the false gods of what we've worshipped when we're younger, and the way that that actually can lift this weight and burden off of you. So it's not only just this negative spiraling downward spiral, but an opportunity for growth and for intellectual growth for women in particular. And so, yeah, all of the characters are, you know, in that headspace. And they're also, I think, what made it interesting to set it at Harvard and have all the characters be Americans and Americans who'd gone to Harvard is that they had a lot further to fall. And that's also something that's really been interesting me lately is to think back to that time as an 18-year-old. For me, it was a bit of a fluke to get into Harvard. I'd never even been to America and had just finished school at North Sydney Girls. And my older sister had applied and figured out that whole system and that you could get financial aid as a foreign student, which is sort of unheard of at most universities. And you have this incredible thing land on your lap and suddenly you're in this community that actually made no sense to me at first, but very quickly realized that it was probably the best thing that was ever going to happen to me in my life. And then you process that, I think, as you get older. And as I put more years between that self and my current self, it does feel more and more like a dream. But I've also been thinking a lot about the pressures that a lot of my American peers were put under when they turned up to Harvard. Harvard meant something a bit different to them. Like to me, it wasn't quite a real world, you know, whereas for them, it was everything. And so what was interesting about checking back in with people at the 15-year reunion and at midlife or early midlife was everybody was letting go of that sense of being told too young that you were special or that you should do, you know, only amazing things with your life. And, you know, while that's very empowering on the one hand, it's also, it's a lot, I think, for a young person to carry with them. And so a lot of people I just noticed were starting to just kind of put that burden down and move away from it. And as a result, were much nicer people, were much more open to speaking about failure and pain and loss at this reunion than they had been at earlier reunions where there was still a bit of, you know, that performative posturing. It's music to your ears because you're aware that you can take the emotional resonance of that experience and then completely invent this set of characters, but put them through those same emotional paces on the page.
Well, the sort of vulnerability that the characters are experiencing and you know, letting themselves put forth is, I think it's quite unique to that time in your life, I guess. I'd be interested to hear how much you took from your own experiences and social group at Harvard for Life After Truth, because there's some obvious parallels. Like the graduating class you're writing about is the class of 2003, your own graduating year. One of the characters, Jules, was already a famous actress when she arrived on campus. Another one of the characters, Frederick, is the son of a recently elected populist president. They do bear some striking resemblances to your own classmates, Natalie Portman and Jared Kushner. So how did your own experiences play into Life After Truth?
So the characters that you hear, the narration is sort of focalized through in the book, are all part of a friendship circle that revolves around an actress, a student who had come to university already famous. But you never actually hear from her and you never hear from the Fred Reese character either. And I think I was interested in the idea that, you know, my graduating class always had these two people who represented something about fame. And I think of it as sort of the light and the dark sides to fame. So sort of fame and infamy. And so the characters are not in any way based on them as people. But I did take the idea of the positions that they were thrust into through, you know, their careers or through their family and used that as a way for the characters who do speak in the book to kind of measure themselves against these two dark and light poles of fame, which kind of again throws into relief in an even more dramatic way the failings that some of these characters feel that they haven't quite measured up. And so they're really just dramatic devices, I think, to help spur that kind of thinking about the characters are thinking about their past and their present.
I did notice that you never actually hear from either of those two characters. I think it's a very interesting device because they're almost these two ultimate protagonists spurring the other characters on, and the other characters spend so much time speculating about them, these two people that we actually never hear from. Yeah, I thought it was a very interesting device. Look, just before we go, the themes of AI and technology and post-humanism are also explored in the book through the characters of Eloise and Banks. And a lot of your nonfiction work actually focuses on big tech and their expansion into outer space capitalism. I would encourage anyone listening to read your essay, Mining the Moon, which won last year's Australian Museum Eureka Award for long-form science journalism, a very prestigious award in the field. It seems to be a theme that you're incredibly passionate about. You've obviously brought it in to your fiction work. What are we going to see next from Kara Dwindoffi? Are you going to continue to explore those themes?
Yeah, I really love working across different forms and genres. And while I'm sure it's incredibly frustrating for my publisher, I'm just curious, I suppose, about the world. And I think of the fiction writing as sort of turning inwards, and then the nonfiction writing as a way to force myself to flex outwards and look out at the world. And so, I'm continuing to write essays on that subject, so on social and environmental justice in outer space and big tech. And then at the same time, sort of processing those ideas into fiction as well. So I'm also going to be working on a new collection of short stories with some kind of space theme. So not science fiction, but I'm trying to think about how to do, you know, more critical speculative fiction in the tradition of feminist writers like Ursula Le Guin and Margaret Atwood. And I'm doing a PhD as well, so on that topic. So
oh, wow.
At Western Sydney University. So I feel very lucky to be able to pursue these things within a beautiful community of people who are also in that same headspace.
Well, sounds like some very exciting things to look forward to. Kara Dwindoffi, thanks so much for joining us on Drive.
Thanks, Tina.